This week on Making Contact.
People coming here weren't coming here to learn, weren't coming here to make new relationships. They were coming here with an agenda, and that their way of life is going to replace what they found here.
Thanksgiving, our national holiday inviting gratitude and fellowship, often stands in stark contrast to the history it represents. The relationship of Native Americans to European and American inhabitants has often been one of profound misunderstanding, betrayal, oppression, and near-cultural genocide. Yet a small collective of Native and non-Native people living along coastal regions of Maine and Canada are working to alter that lasting legacy. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, battle ideas, and important information. The group has been meeting for the past 20 years in Portland, Maine, first brought together by the Center for Vision and Policy. They seek to make Thanksgiving not a holiday isolated from the harsh social realities of American life, but a gathering designed to bring that social reality into line with the ideals we celebrate. Blair Brown of Peace Talks will be our guide, telling the story of that small group's journey and fellowship.
15 years ago, Geeson Tonemuk, a spiritual teacher from the Wampanoag Nation, and Shirley Hager of Portland, Maine, began working together to organize the first gathering.
There was a desire to create a forum for people to come together and discover the connections among economic, social, and environmental justice, and how to live rightly with one another and with the land. So there began an effort to bring together Native peoples and non-Native peoples so that all the voices would be heard.
What got me interested was their openness to invite Wabanaki people of this bioregion in the Northeast to help them through the question of how we all live rightly with the land. They had the foresight to know that for them to answer that question, they have to have a dialogue with the people of the land and not the customary way of excluding First Nations voices. And I was really impressed with that.
The organization of the first gathering was at a retreat center, very beautiful retreat center on the coast of Maine. And we conceived of panels, of course, panels of Native people speaking to us. We would ask questions, the audience. It was a dialogue, more or less.
The original gatherings was more a forum of what Westerners understand of as conferences, and so they had a set agenda and time frames and questions and answers. And that existed for the first 2 years, and after that, the Wabanaki who are participating in this suggested that, you know, maybe we can expand this a little bit, or maybe we can offer a different forum for these discussions. So we introduced the idea of ceremony, and they were open to that.
At the end of the second gathering, I remember a conversation with a couple of Native people, and they said, you know, if we're going to continue to be part of this, we need to meet in a way that really allows dialogue and getting to know one another. And we would really like to propose meeting in a traditional way.
So we introduced the idea of ceremony, opening these gatherings or these discussions in a ceremonial fashion that the Wabanaki were accustomed to when we gather for our councils. That introduction of ceremony into the work that was ahead of us all transformed the relationships and transformed our participation in this in really profound ways that we didn't envision along the way.
So how it would typically begin is that people would arrive on Friday night, loaded down with coolers of food, and people would sit around and talk, usually fairly late, and then would kind of drift away to set up tents. And sometime during the evening, Geeson Tonemuk would go and begin to build the fire.
Thank you.
I would be aware that people were watching the fire all night. So then we were awakened for first light, a first light ceremony. And it's dark and it's cold, and people would sort of stumble out with their sleeping bags wrapped around their shoulders and, you know, wool hats pulled down over their heads.
When everything is ready, we call each other. We have the same procedure when we invite the sacred. So the initial part of the ceremony is I make an invocation.
We would come together, the fire was burning, and Gisatanamuk would give thanks in his words. Then each one of us would come to the fire.
And then we shared tobacco. And through the tobacco, we're focusing what it is that we want to share. Circumstances in your life, in your community, your family, your nation.
The purpose was for us to offer our prayers for the day ahead and for our work together and to give thanks.
Following the tobacco, we share a communion of water. Water is the first medicine, is the life keeper of the people. And then the last part of the ceremony is when we sing a song. And then we close the ceremony with a personal greeting to each other, usually a handshake or a hug.
And as we were in the circle, the sky would begin to lighten. And by the end of it, usually the sun was up.
The group began to meet around a fire and adopted the Native American custom of passing the talking stick. This way, the force of every person's thoughts, and not the force of any single personality, drives the dynamics of the group. Wesley Rothermel, a non-Native member of the gathering, explains.
What we would do is get together in a circle, in a talking circle. We have a stick or some object that whoever holds that object speaks, and everybody else has to listen. And they can talk as long as they want. There are no limits. It could go on for 2 hours. It could go on for the whole day. And that's hard.
The purpose is to give the person holding the stick the time and space to speak for as long as they need to. And then they pass it on when they're finished. I suppose it's like a spiral that the level of sharing got deeper and deeper and deeper as the stick went around over the weekend. And the most important thing was that people didn't leave the circle no matter what.
We'll now come to the fire and pass the talking stick in turn to the five members of the gathering who came together recently to reflect on their 15-year history and describe the profound effect that fellowship has had on their lives. You will hear from Wesley Rothermel, Gisatanamuk, Migamahan, Gisatanamuk's wife and a Mi'kmaq community leader, Shirley Hager, and Wayne Newell, a Passamaquoddy from Indian Township.
I'm Wesley Rothermel. I live in Belfast, Maine. My story begins in the early 70s. I picked up this book and read it, and I couldn't believe what I was reading. The Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee by Dee Brown. And when I read that, I became angry. Since I read that book, I haven't stopped reading. And it's fascinating to hear about the history of Western civilization from a non-white person. We live here in the Gulf of Maine bioregion, which extends all the way from Cape Cod to the south to Newfoundland. And that includes Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Maine. And the Wabanaki people inhabit that region. They're the indigenous people there. We're talking about the Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, Passamaquoddy, and Penobscot. And those are the new people that are part of our group. From my perspective, really the issue has been is that they know that we're there, we've made a commitment to our relationship, not to an issue or not to the plight of Indian people, it was to the relationship. And that's what's made the difference.
Gisatanamuk, we have the opportunity in our generation to lay the foundation of real peace, of healing. And we have to develop the courage to gather ourselves together, to do the work that nobody wants to do. You know, we can joke with each other, but it took a whole lot of work and a lot of pain to get to that point where we're no longer looking at each other as Indian white, we're looking at each other as friends and family. And I think that's the goal. I'm used to ceremonies with our own people, but to see a whole different shade of hands, a whole different people who are opening themselves up, it helped me understand that the original intent of our ancestors were to bring them into our longhouse, that we would experience heart to heart and warmth to warmth and have that kind of connection as human beings. I think that's where the second chance is. That's what's important about building and forging this relationship, because nothing is going to be successful if we don't heal what's been done. Being part of this gathering and this group of people really helped me through my own racism, my own faulty conclusions that white people can't be trusted. That even to use the term white people is a separation of our humanity. I was able to transform that distinction to be able to look at my colleagues as really family. And that only happens when we share in a forum that's safe. What this gathering did for me was to help me realize that it's not about being white or being Indian, and that if this small group of people are willing to engage that, then it's possible for us all.
We'll hear more of The Gathering, produced by Barbara Simmons and Laura Jackson of Nightingale Productions, in just a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. For more information, or for a CD copy of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Turn to The Gathering, narrated by Blair Brown of Peace Talks.
I'm a Mi'kmaq woman. My name is Mi'kmaq Hunt, and I'm a mother of three children and a wonderful partner, Kisitanamuk. I would go with him to different gatherings, knowing that I didn't want to be part of the meeting. I didn't want to be part of anything like that. And in my mind, I've always had an impression that all white people were so privileged and that they didn't have the kind of problems that we had. I had this impression that they just had a perfect life. And I was jealous and angry by all that. I know that I was very racist. And I've justified my actions by saying that it's a righteous anger. We have every right to just label everybody in one, you know, one category. That one does that to you, it's all, it's the whole race. And what began to really open me up was hearing my own people talking about what I was feeling. And so when they were talking about all that, bringing that out, and I observed the expressions and just really observing the white people about how they were responding to this, and they were really listening. I was kind of surprised, you know, and that they weren't reacting to the anger and the hurt, even though a lot of our own members were pretty insulting because they were angry, you know, and so, and they, most of the people, non-Native, sat there listening, and you can tell that they were open and that they were really listening. So I went in to test the waters too. I said, well, I want to go and say something too. It was important for me to hear it from the white race people that yes, what our ancestors did is wrong, what the institutions and what the policies are doing to your people is wrong, and we recognize that. It's been a long struggle for me, you know, and I can say now, you know, that it's changed my life, and I've made not just allies, but in my heart, good friends.
Shirley Hager, Portland, Maine.
I think anger came first. After, you know, after politeness came anger. And of course, you could feel very uncomfortable, and you just knew that all you could do was stay and listen. People didn't try to defend themselves or make excuses. The white people began to talk about their own guilt, what it was like to carry around this knowledge of what our ancestors had done and what our culture is still doing. And, you know, we began to really break down some of those barriers.
A Native man arrived at one of the gatherings with a young white woman. And the presence of this couple touched off a lot of anger, particularly among some of the Native women, and brought up a lot of issues around white women becoming involved with Native men, pulling them out of their community. And one of the Native women stood up and expressed a lot of anger toward, I think, both of them. That stands out for me because no one walked away, including the couple. There were times like that when I would crawl into my tent at night and I would lie there feeling like when I wake up, no one will be here. Everyone will have packed up and gone. And I would wake up and we would all come together around the fire in the middle of the night, it felt like, say our prayers and do it again.
I'm Wayne. I'm Passamaquoddy. The business of coming together with non-Natives was not a new thing for me. And my expectations were that we would make some sort of a presentation. People would receive information, they would react to it, and we'd all be on our way. Quite to the contrary, I found something different with this gathering of people. I found us looking at issues that would hold us in common as opposed to issues that would separate us or issues that could help us work together, not lend us to maybe blaming each other. I would hear thought-provoking questions. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't want to deal with them myself. They were hard things because I knew that if I tried to deal with them, I'd have to deal with them for myself. And sometimes that's not easy. Sometimes it can be real difficult. I needed to form a relationship with particularly the white culture, the culture that I resented and that I was angry at for doing all of the things that happened. There seemed to emerge an element, and those people don't like to use this word today, I know, but I do, an element of love. I felt it, as a result of feeling it, I tried to give it. Even when I was angry, even when I was inadvertently insulted. The group itself gave me the power to want to do this in a real right way. That was something I didn't even think about. I didn't plan on. It was like a butterfly when it comes out of the cocoon. You know, they see this beautiful world emerging, and it's certainly something that I could never, never create myself. It was a gift.
Over the years, members of the gathering have worked together on cross-cultural projects outside the circle, taking the gift of their fellowship into the real world. Recently, they resolved to bring that gift to bear upon one of the harsh realities faced on a daily basis by the Mi'kmaq people, their confrontation with the Canadian government and commercial fishing interests over local fishing rights. Leo Bartibog, one of Mi'kmahan's brothers, is a native fisherman on the Mi'kmaq Reserve. Every morning before going to his job, Leo checks and sets his 12 lobster traps 1 mile offshore.
I try to come out once a day, because I have other work that I'm doing, so it provides food for my family, but you know, I enjoy doing this, no matter how the weather is. My great-grandfather did it, and I seen him doing it. So that really means a lot to me, because our ancestors did it, and we're doing it, and you know, it's for our survival, that's what it is. So.
Since 1998, disagreements over treaty rights have erupted into violence as both non-native fishermen and the Canadian government have contested and tried to control the Mi'kmaq's access to natural resources, in this case, lobsters. The history of these disputes is complicated. Wesley Rothermel explains.
There's been the treaties that were signed centuries ago between the Mi'kmaq people and Britain before Canada was even formed. And those treaty rights allowed the Mi'kmaq to the resources, to the fishing, and to continue their way of life. Well, the Canadian Supreme Court a few years ago reaffirmed treaty rights for the Mi'kmaq to earn a moderate living from fishing. And they got boats, traps, and they put them out into the water during the off season of fishing. So the white fishermen went out and cut the trap, lines to the traps, and pulled the traps. That's when the confrontation started. And there's an issue about the amount of catch. What's the amount that they're entitled to take from the water? The Mi'kmaq say, well, we can have as many as we want. The Canadian government says, no, there's a certain number, and you got to have a license. And the Mi'kmaq say, we don't need a license. So the Canadian government's fighting the idea that they don't have control of everything. And the Mi'kmaq resisted this for years.
But you know, I never gave up. I never gave up, not one bit. Neither did my family. Mi'kmahan, Kizitamuk, a whole bunch of them that were there with us during the dispute. Not just them, but a lot of good people in our community and around Canada and U.S. And it takes a people like that to get together to make things happen. Not just for our future, but everybody else's.
For the past few years, Wesley has been one of many non-natives invited by the Mi'kmaqs to stand with them and observe the confrontations. The observer's testimony later in court would provide credible witness to all that went on. The Mi'kmaqs had learned over the years that their own testimony was not taken seriously.
There are two big Coast Guard boats out there, and they are picking up the traps.
Well, given my own experience in the fishing season in 2000, everybody was gathered at Mi'kmahan's mother's home. That's where everybody gathered to see what was happening out in the water. The TV cameras were there. The radio stations were there. All this equipment was there, focused in this one area.
There's a skirmish out there now with several small dories. The larger boats are circling and trying to swamp the little boats to scare them off. I believe one boat is down. There are several people in the water. I believe they are now being arrested.
Well, I want to do something. Of course, I want to say something. I want to be active, but it's hard for me just to be there, just to stand there, and only respond to what I'm asked to do. That was my role. That's my way of showing my support to the relationship.
Again, Leo Bartibog.
You know, at that time,
when all things happened, I had a lot of distrust on non-Native people. And so it was very hard for me to accept non-Native just like that. Although a little while after, I started realizing that, you know, not everybody's alike. The observers were here to try and help us to get the information out to the people. And so I started really understanding that, and it got a little bit more easy for me to trust. So it just started coming as time progressed. And when it did, I really wound up with really good friends and a lot of people that I've trusted at the end. And that's the number one thing I thought, the bond that we all had, we established all through the offense.
Like the process that brought fellowship to the gathering, the dispute over fishing rights will not be resolved quickly, but it will be resolved more openly. The rights of the Mi'kmaq Nation, given them in their original treaties with Britain, will no longer be trampled with impunity. The members of the gathering understand that Thanksgiving is not just a holiday, but a process, and that fellowship is a gift earned through hard work, perseverance, and vision. Again, Gisantanamuk.
When we're doing this kind of work, cross-cultural work, it's easy to superficially suggest that we need to have a dialogue, but not be committed to the point where we have to deal with the real hardcore issues. That's what it's really going to take to finally resolve, come to a resolve where we can actually live together in this part of the world in peace, in respect and in dignity, not just for First Nations, but all people.
Shirley Hager.
I celebrate Thanksgiving with my friends in about as traditional a way as anyone else in this culture. And I don't think there's been a Thanksgiving in the last few years that I haven't thought about. Wouldn't it be wonderful if when my people landed here, that they'd gotten off the boats, someone had built a fire, we had all sat down together, and my people had said, well, we're here, can we stay? And if we can, how are we going to do this together?
As we gather this Thanksgiving with family, neighbors, and friends, we should acknowledge that we've fallen short of attaining the ideals we celebrate of tolerance, diversity, and community. The work of the gathering should inspire us to recognize, however, that they are the right ideals, and that we must work towards their fulfillment, not just every fourth Thursday in November, but every day of the year.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. The gathering was produced by Peace Talks. Producers are Barbara Simmons and Laura Jackson of Nightingale Productions, engineer Mike Simmons of Mars Studio, and associate producer Katie Sowiak. Special thanks to Dan Turner, Ron Recker, and the Monday Morning Breakfast Crew. For a CD copy of program number 4707, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Puck Lowe associate producer, Joaquin Palomino and Samson Rainey interns, and I'm senior producer Tina Rubio. From all of us at Making Contact, have a happy holiday.